Radio Live.
We're hoping you're having a pleasant day if you're on the grounds at AirVenture. I know it's a little soggy out there, but we're here to see the airplanes, and that's why we're here anyway. I'm Farid Gio, and this is EAA Radio Live. It's Navy Day, and I promise we won't have a sing-along of Anchors Away, but you'll probably be hearing that a lot today, and we won't ask our guests either to do a sing-along of Anchors Away. Is that required when you join the Navy?
No, it's actually against the no funny hats, no singing. We okay. Never do that.
And I won't ask Major General John Crowley to sing Anchors Away. He's got his own hymn to sing as well. And I'm also joined by Rear Admiral Patrick McGrath, United States Navy. Thank you, gentlemen, both for being here. Their first time at AirVenture, and they're having a great time. We were talking a little bit about tactics of finding submarines, and then we were talking a little bit about patrolling an entire ocean. With the new technology like satellite and unmanned aircraft, how often, and you had Admiral McGrath, you had reference about the dawn and dusk patrols. How are squadrons aboard carriers and having shorter flight cycles and patrol cycles because of some of this other technology? Are they utilized as much in the air?
I think it's more carefully balanced, don't you?
Sure.
I don't know if I'd put it that way, but I certainly think our capability is more targeted than... And if you look at the advent of technology post-World War II, Korea, the multi-layers of intelligence, we're only as good tactically as the intelligence that we collect. So I keep bringing back the full spectrum of pictures. You have imagery that can be collected from satellites. You have unmanned aerial vehicles in the down below the stratosphere that we haven't even began to scratch the surface. We're in the early days of aviation with unmanned aerial vehicles, and especially with these great aviators that are here today. Nobody wants to talk about an unmanned aerial vehicle. They'll probably hiss and boo, and I can't blame them if they did, and I'm part of that too because I'm an old guy. But you look at unmanned aerial vehicles as part of the system that will connect into a joint strike fighter, into a rotary wing platform attack platform that's out there. It might be connecting back into the combat information center on the flagship that the Commodore is running the fight. All that comes back. Unmanned aerial vehicles will never be, in my opinion, at least in our lifetimes, I don't think, the automatrons that we think they're going to be from something in the future. Certainly, they're additive, they're tools, and we'll continue to use them like that. And we have a lot to draw out of that technology in the future. And we're using unmanned aerial vehicles in everything from finding IEDs, improvised explosive devices. Our engineers are using those because they're using them as a tool. They go out, they help them track them, they're able to jam them alongside of a road, and doesn't put a human being in that order. To sit back and think that a unmanned aerial vehicle, that we're going to be able to fight this war sitting behind a console over there and not have some intrepid naval aviator or Air Force airman out there selecting targets and making that decision to engage in a target or for personnel recovery for a SAR pickup. No, that's not going to happen. Not in these next few years anyway.
And you'll be talking a little bit about the future tomorrow right here at the Welcome Center at 10 o'clock. You'll be giving a presentation. So those of you coming back tomorrow, at least in the flesh, come on back here and see this presentation. Let's talk a little bit about the person who was supposed to be here, Vice Admiral John Currier, the United States Coast Guard. You were talking about how it seems the Coast Guard folks, especially up in Alaska, seem to sweep the Best Pilot Awards all the time.
Well, it's interesting. I'm a member of the Naval Helicopter Association. That's Naval. It's not Navy. And originally it was Navy and Marine Corps. And I've been a member of this organization for 30 years. And about 10 years, someone said, well, we should invite the Coast Guard. And I think that was the last time any of us ever won Rescue of the Year Award, because we would do things that were good, And then you've seen this on these shows in northern Alaska. You see the Coast Guard in the middle of the night picking people up, dropping people off in Arctic waters and picking them off the front of pitching boats. And they're filming it, too, which is just amazing. So the Coast Guard has changed the dynamic of what we consider really, really dramatic rescues, because for us, that would be extraordinary. For them, it's almost routine.
Well, let's do a little story time here. Talk about an experience that you've had at sea or at least on deployment that kind of just made you think, this is why I joined the military.
Well, there were a number of things for me that were dramatic, but I'll tell you, this is for the old guys in the crowd. I started in 1980, and this was the era of the evil empire. And I remember one of the aircraft commander questions they would ask you is, if you were in an aircraft that was crippled, in a helicopter, and you had the choice between putting it in the ocean and taking your chance in freezing waters and dying, or landing on a Soviet ship, what would you do? And we'd all say, oh, we'd put it in the water and die, you know, because we were that strong. And the first time I went to sea, I remember we were told we had intelligence that a Soviet intelligence ship might be on the horizon. Now, this is some poor guy who was there to follow us, and we were there to follow him. So we got the word that they were out there, and we launched, and I was a young pilot. We had all these rules of what we could and could not do. You couldn't go within 500 feet of them. You couldn't do all of this and do all of that. Well, anyway, the aircraft commander I had, we fly this helicopter up, and I start rattling off these rules. And he pulls into a hover right next to this bridge of this Soviet intelligence ship. And you can tell it's a cylinder ship. It's a fishing boat with 10,000 antennas on it. And it's a rust bucket. And we're sitting there, and my heart is racing like a maniac because I don't know what's going to happen. And I'll never forget this. The door to the bridge wing opens up, and a guy jumps out wearing one of those big Russian hats and a Cossack jacket and starts dancing. He starts doing this, and we start laughing, and he waves at us, and we wave at him. And so every day for the next week or so, we'd swing by and salute him. And so it was funny. You went there, you know, thinking this big dramatic thing. But I remember just thinking, this is pretty cool stuff.
And I suppose, you know, Russia or the Soviet Union at the time and the United States obviously had this Cold War going, and there was a lot of tension. But I suppose there was a lot of just kind of camaraderie amongst the opposing sides when you saw each other out there on deployments.
Well, there were some incidents, but frankly, and looking back on it now, this is with it. They were there in some ways to trail us. We knew they were there. There were times, because I was a young guy, I wasn't in the meetings, but essentially we'd establish some sort of rules. We wouldn't turn in front of their ship. They wouldn't turn. There was respect. And the other thing, when I look back on it, and you'd see those ships, our ships were kind of new and they looked really good. And a lot of their ships, they looked like they were having a much harder time than we were. So with the perspective of 30 years looking back on it, it was just a very interesting time, and there were a lot of interactions between the forces, and fortunately, no one ever did anything stupid.
General Crowley, any experiences that you always think about when you say, "I'm glad I did this"?
Well, nobody can tell us a good story like an Irishman, so that you did very well. First of all, I know there's a lot of folks in the crowd here that have served their country. And do we have any naval aviators that are in here, that have?
Go ahead and clap. This is radio. Support, please. Clap, please.
And also, there's just some and there's veterans here too. If you served in the United States Marine Corps or Navy or in any armed service, please raise your hand. We want to thank you for that, especially when we focus on. I got to get my paid political advertisement in here. We truly appreciate you being here and blazing the trails for us. Else, we would not be here. And these past 10 years for what we represent up here as a naval service have been very challenging and trying. And there's some tough days ahead. As the nation is focused outside these gates today on the budget And folks like Pat McGrath and I unfortunately have to sit down with spreadsheets and determine where money goes. And if you had asked me as a first lieutenant going out on his first amphibious float and flying God's death machine called the AH-1 Cobra, I would have said, you're full of it. But I got to tell you that nothing is more gratifying when you're sitting on the deck, and this is the way of my story, that you're armed to the teeth, you've practiced your craft time after time again in various conditions, and you're chained to the deck of that ship, and you launch in defense of this great republic to go carry out your mission. And I was never more gratified to do that off the coast of Lebanon. I was never more gratified to do that when I my squadron got recalled to active duty to send 14 Cobras and fly armed escort for minesweeping operations, some things that we forget with HM-14, and to be able to execute your trade. There is nothing more rewarding than that. And I know many of you have flown in those conditions, and you, the American taxpayer, has given us that that investment very, very gratuitously, very kindly, and thoughtfully. We fly the best aviation equipment in the world. We have the best maintained aircraft and programs in the world. There's something called the Naval Aviation Enterprise. And we have learned, I think, to spend and make investments smarter. And please, I hope you know this, that your tax dollars are spent very wisely in that investment and looked at. We look at it every month. And each type, model, series of kind of aircraft that we fly, we look at that very carefully in protecting this investment called naval aviation. And it'll go on for many more years and as robustly and as powerful as it has over the past 100 years.
How does one become a naval aviator? I mean, when I first looked at the military back when I was getting out of high school, it was you could go into service academies. A lot of them said, go to school first and then come see us. And a lot of times you had to apply to your reserve squadrons nearby. Where are we now with recruiting, especially now that we've been involved in several engagements and there's, you know, people of retirements and so on?
Well, number one, we've never had a finer quality of people, United States citizens, in the military, period. Naval aviation or not, okay? And today, we are going to have some pressures put on us to maybe be a little bit smaller in the naval service. To be a naval aviator, you have to have a college degree, and then you go through one of the programs. You might go to the Naval Academy. You might go through a four-year college, and you might go through Naval ROTC. You might go through an officer candidate program. And then you come to Pensacola, Florida, is where it all starts. And we are unrestricted aviators. Yeah, I know we talked a lot about fling wing up here. But we started out, we're unrestricted aviators. We can fly both. Hell, I'm a captain for American Airlines. I mean, you know, you can get there. And that's the beauty of being an unrestricted aviator. We cut our teeth very early on in earning our wings of gold. You go to Pensacola. And sometimes we have joint training that goes on in some of the Air Force bases, but you start down there. You come out of a commissioning program, and you'll spend up to 18 months going through what we call your pipeline. You go through primary aviation, and we see how you do there, and then based on your grades, you select a pipeline. It might be rotary wing, it might be multi-engine, or it might be the jet pipeline. And then we branch you out from there into the various areas. So the United States government makes a big investment in you, and it's right shy of $1 million per student.
Any thoughts?
That question usually gets asked by 16-year-old boys and girls that I've met all over the country in the last year. And the bottom line is you can get to fly these aircraft. There is a path. And Pensacola, as far as the Navy, Pensacola is the place you need to go. You need to work hard, you need to do well in school, and you need to research it. But we're looking for good people. We always have. We got great people now, and we'll continue to get them. I've met a couple of people here. I'm sure they'll be going through flight school soon.
I remember going to a job fair when I was in high school, and I remember talking to the Navy recruiter and saying, "I want to fly planes." And he says, "You know," and he says, "Well, yeah, that's great, and we'd like to talk with you and so on." But also, what about the people who want to fly planes? Do you also talk to them about other opportunities as well, just in case?
Well, one of the things, you always have to have a plan B.
Yeah.
You wear glasses. I have readers here. I'm a LASIK guy. So when I went to flights, when I went to the Naval Academy, I did not pass my flight physical because my eyes were not good enough and fought 2 years for a waiver to be able to go to flight school wearing glasses. This is 30 years ago. Not a lot of guys got to do that. So I could have gone through a physical, and they found that I had some allergy that I couldn't fly. And the thing is, if you want to be in the Naval Service, many people get to fly, but sometimes you can't do it. There are many things you can do as a naval officer that is extraordinary work, where you work with extraordinary people, where you don't actually fly the aircraft. Some people are navigators. Some people support putting the aircraft in the air. It's all valuable work. It's great to be the person actually at the controls, but the team needs a lot more people than just the pilot.
We are just running out of time, so any more thoughts about the Centennial and other maybe other events that people can see around the country as this year goes on?
Well, I've been to a half a dozen of these events, and I'll keep this short. Let me just say this. You know, people always like to say things were better in the old days, but I have been to a half a dozen events across the country, and one of the things that has changed since the old days for me, 30 years ago, I didn't wear my uniform a whole lot when I was on Liberty just because I didn't want, you know, this is 1979. People would sit there and go, "Why'd you join the military?" Nowadays, when I walk through an airport and someone sees me in uniform, they walk up and say, "Thank you for your service." I think as a country, across the board, we have gotten a lot better about thanking the emergency providers, the cops, the firemen, the EMT, the military people, for making sacrifices for the rest of it. I've had that constantly here. To be around good people that appreciate what you do is just extraordinary. So I think it bodes well for our future.
We'd just like to thank you for the opportunity that you positioned us for success. And thank you, United States of America, for positioning us for success in the future.
So I'd like to thank my guests, Rear Admiral Patrick McGrath of the United States Navy and John Crowley of the United States Marine Corps. Let's thank them. And don't forget General Crowley's presentation tomorrow at 10 o'clock here. You're listening to EAA Radio Live.